BadQuicker.com podcast, where liberty is our mission. Today is Monday, December 17th, 2012, and this is podcast number 248. My name is Ben Stone, and with me again today is Kai, my co-host.
Hello.
And what do we want to talk about before we talk about what we're going to talk about? We have anything to talk about before we talk about what we're going to talk about?
We could mention. Have we shouted out the forum lately?
And we could mention the forum
and let people know that we do in fact have a forum and that it's super cool and that's where all the cool kids are. All the happening kids are on the forum.
You can go to badquaker.com and over on the upper right hand side, you'll see a link to the forum. And we do have about what are we at, like 127 members currently. And there's a pretty active discussion over the weekend, so that's kind of fun stuff there. And then what else we got going on? Oh, you know what? Will Coley from Muslims for Liberty, a story about him got picked up by Huffington Post.
Nice.
I'll put a link in today's – I mentioned it the other day, but I want to mention it again. I'll put a link in today's show notes for that because it's really cool to see Will get attention like that. And it's for such a good cause too. And, you know, Huffington Post is they tend to be, you know, liberal wackos.
Right.
But there's some good people over there, and they often have good stories. So, you know, it's a, what do they say? A broke clock is still right twice a day, you know? So we can still get stuff from people like Huffington Post and from, I started to say Bill O'Reilly, but no, I guess I'm proven wrong there.
Yeah, I don't know that there's anything that comes out of Bill O'Reilly that's even marginally good.
So now we should have a little bit of a correction because I took a little bit of heat, not really a lot, but just we have a little bit of a clarification that we need to talk about. When we were talking about property the other day, and we were talking about, you know, working out sort of, well, what can we do about the injustices of what has been done to the American Indians and all the property that was stolen from them, all the land that was stolen from them. And then, you know, we came to the conclusion, well, actually, no one alive stole that property, that real estate, from anybody who's alive. So if the government weren't here, then, you know, vast millions and millions and millions of acres would be open to homesteading. And it would be to whoever can, you know, obtain control, improve, and maintain control of that property would be up to them.
Mm-hmm.
But no one would have the right to go to somebody's house and just take it because your great 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 grandfather got ripped off by somebody else's great 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 grandfather.
Right.
You know. And then so the accusation then, or the misunderstanding or whatever, came about that what we were really saying was that as soon as a person dies, all property rights die with them. And then it's just a mad scramble to steal their stuff, or no, I shouldn't say steal, but to grab their stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And this argument was, well, doesn't inheritance mean something? Isn't there something in inheritance? But really, inheritance is not a right.
Mm-mm.
It's a cultural tradition. Once a person dies, they don't have rights to anything. They're not here. They're gone.
Right.
You can believe they're in heaven, or you believe their ghost wanders, or you can believe they're entirely gone and, you know, out of existence, or you can believe anything in between, or they're recycling into another being, or you can, anything you want to believe is just your belief. But the fact is, they're not here, and therefore they have no property rights. And then whatever, culturally, whatever we develop as a tradition as to how to divide up the dead person's stuff, that is strictly a cultural thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there have been cultures that said, well, when a person dies, everything they own goes to their spouse. there have been other cultures that said everything that they own goes to their youngest or to their oldest or to their oldest male or to their oldest female. And then again, you have a guy like Carnegie, the ultra rich guy from the 1800s. And when he died, he didn't give his children, you know, vast amounts of wealth. He thought that would spoil them. He made them earn their own money, and he put his money into charities instead. So, you know, once you're dead, if we know your intent, then it would be nice of those of us who are still alive to fulfill your desires. But that's just a nicety.
Right.
That's, you don't have any right to demand that you're dead. What are you going to do? Come back and sue me?
Well, and I think if you don't like that idea, mm-hmm. then deal with all of your stuff before you die.
Yeah. Or hire some agency to make some kind of guarantee, and then it'll be up to their reputation to make sure that your wishes are accomplished.
Right.
If you can't trust your relatives or whatever, you know, in the cases we've seen in the last year, dividing up dead people's stuff, you know, we're getting pretty good at that. We've had enough deaths in the family this year that we've... Oh, that's something else. In a totally different note, I should mention this. I was talking about something some time back, and I think it was not long after my dad had died, and I was talking about something unrelated, and then I just kind of went off on mortuaries and funeral directors and those people. And I thought in the moment, you know, you ever start to say something, and right as you're starting to say it, your brain says, don't say that, don't say that. But then it's too late because you're saying it and you're like, no, I'm going to say it. I don't care. I'm going to say it.
Your mouth is like, shut up, brain. This is happening.
Yeah. Yep. You're not in control, brain. Shut up and sit down. Where were you during those tests in high school? So, anyway, I said some pretty nasty things about, you know, mortuary directors and funeral directors and morticians and so forth. And then I kind of felt bad. I thought, well, they got to make a living. And then I thought, no, they don't have to make a living ripping people off, because that's what they do.
Right.
They use a particularly gruesome set of idiotic traditions that are forced upon us by law. And then they use that to place guilt upon people. Using the law to place guilt upon people, to say, you can't do these things within your family. You have to hire us to do them for you, and we're going to charge you ridiculous amounts, and you can't. There's competition only within their little government-supplied guild.
Mm-hmm.
There's not open competition. You can't go to Walmart and get this done. You can't just call up, you know, the automotive
place.
You
can buy a coffin from Walmart, though.
But not. You can't always get the funeral director that you want to use the coffin that you've supplied.
This is true.
And it's such a ridiculous thing to have to deal with all these layers of stuff. You know, paperwork with the state is bad enough, but then to have to deal with the ridiculous markups that these people, you know, they're just false sympathy. I mean, it's, you take your car to a mechanic and he sees that your car is really messed up and it's going to take a lot, you know, and he realizes maybe you don't have a lot of money. I'm sure he has a certain amount of sympathy for you, but at the same time, it's, to him, it's just a car.
Mm-hmm.
And really and truly, I mean, I hate to say this, but if you're dealing with dead bodies every single day, it's pretty much the same. It's really difficult if you're dealing with dead bodies on a daily basis. It's really difficult to come up with sympathy, but you can come up with false sympathy.
Mm-hmm.
That's really easy. That's just acting. And in many cases with the guy with the car, you know, the auto mechanic can give you just as much false sympathy as the mortuary director.
Right.
Okay, how about let's be honest about this, you know? How about, yeah, I know it's a hard situation, something we got to get done. Let's see if we can just take care of as quickly as possible. If there wasn't a government-provided monopoly to this one guild of funeral directors, then the mechanic could handle those things. He could, adjust your steering for you on your car, take care of the dead body in your trunk, everything, all in one-stop shopping, you know?
Yeah. The way barbers used to be dentists.
Sure. And why can't they be now? I mean, really. You know, honestly, carpenters would probably make the very best dentists if they were allowed. Because they're, maybe not carpenters, but, you know, people with high levels of woodworking skill.
Mm-hmm.
Because basically, you're talking the same thing, carving, drilling, you know. It's once the person is knocked out and, well, I shouldn't say knocked out, but...
What irritates me is that you used to be able to just go and get a tooth pulled. And you can't do that nowadays.
Yeah, they have to go through the cleaning. They have to go through all this kind of other rigmarole before they ever get around to deciding whether or not they will pull your tooth or not.
And most of the time, they don't want to. They want to drill it out, completely kill the tooth, fill it full of epoxy.
And leave a dead tooth in your mouth.
And leave a dead tooth in your mouth.
Yeah.
Yay, fun. Or you could just pull it out.
Yeah. So now we're going to have dentists mad at us, too. And actually, I brought that up about the morticians and so forth, and I actually had someone email me and say, look, I was in that industry, I was taking the classes, I was going through it, and you're right. Mm-hmm. What you're saying is true, and these and they're the people behind the scenes, you know, their attitudes about the customers is really bad, the amount of markup is ridiculous, and it is really false sympathy. It's all just an act. They really... And then, you know... I hate to get too personal, but I'll just say, in dealing with the different mortuaries that we've dealt with this year, and we've dealt with several, and each one had oddities, let's say. Like one particular one was really, like the Munsters trying to be serious. You know, it was that level of ghoulish. It was like if the Munsters were trying to be serious. That's right. What it was like. The other one was really nice, very professional. I was really impressed with everything that they handled themselves. But then they keep calling us every couple months saying, hey, why don't you come on down? We're having a support get-together dinner and meet and greet. And it's like, I don't want to come to your funeral home and rub elbows with other people who had people die in their family this year that I don't even know.
Yeah.
I have no idea. Why not just, like, you know, get over the trauma of death? And then we've got the third mortuary in a third state. These are on three different states. And during one of the viewing services,
two states.
No, three states. Missouri, Ohio, and Kentucky. Yeah, three states. That's three different states.
Yeah, but that was in Portsmouth, and that's in Ohio.
No, the funeral home was in Kentucky. That's in South Shore. Now we're narrowing it down to two funeral homes. Okay, Robinson's funeral home in South Shore, Kentucky. Yeah, I'll be that. Because it was a bad situation. I'm in there, and my dad's viewing, and it's in the morning. And so I break away, and it's a moment when it's kind of calm. I don't know if I've even told you this story or not, but it's kind of calm, and I thought, okay, well, I have to go to the bathroom. So I wander around, find the bathroom. Well, the funeral home, like many of these older funeral homes, is a house that's been converted into a funeral home.
Right.
So the bathroom is literally just like a house's bathroom. And so I wander around, find it, go in to go to the bathroom, and the walls are like paper thin in there. So I can hear where the funeral worker people are in their break room, and you can hear it right through the bathroom wall, and they're making racial jokes about Obama.
Uh-huh.
Now, I'm not, you know, anybody who's hearing my voice probably realizes that I'm not a fan of the murderer Obama.
Right.
You know, the guy who kills children for a living and then tears up when there's a shooting at a school and children are killed. Really? Let's see. Why is that? Why is it okay for him to give the approval, personally giving the approval to kill an American 16-year-old child, to kill that child along with others that were with him that were not even accused of a crime? That's perfectly okay for this president. But if some crazy person goes into a school and starts shooting children, then he's going to come on the cameras and tear up for us.
Mm-hmm.
What a hypocrite. You know, that should be something that where a war crime. He should be under trial for that, and I'll say that publicly.
Well, so, yeah, and this is Mr. Nobel Peace Prize winner.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm no love, you know, I have no love for Obama. I think he's a war criminal, and I think he should be arrested. I think he should be dragged out of the White House by his heels, dragged out of there, handcuffed in front of the White House, just like you would handcuff a protester or anything else, and drug in, you know, and thrown into jail and tried. I think that. So I have no love of that man.
At least.
At least. But anyway, back to my story. So here I am in the bathroom.
You know, the Italians did far worse to Mussolini for far less.
Actually, that's true.
I'm just saying.
Yeah. Mussolini's fate would be, I'd be okay with that. A mob, yeah. Mobs can bring about justice very, very thoroughly. Anyway, so we'll see the Secret Service people here pretty soon, I suppose. But so I have no love of Obama, right? So here I am at my dad's viewing in the bathroom of the funeral place, and I can hear the workers making racial jokes about Obama through the wall and laughing about it. And I'm just like, you people are scum. You are absolute scum, you know? But then you think about it, and well, it's just their job.
Mm-hmm.
They're just a bunch of rednecks, and they're really no different than the guys at the garage or the guys, you know, at the plumbing supply store or the guys at any other business. They're just people. They're just guys doing their job.
Yeah, but they weren't even doing their job well.
No. Yeah. You can at least keep... Well, it would be different, you know. It's like, oh, they don't make enough money to insulate the bathroom so we can't hear into their... Anyway. I suppose it's not a appropriate rants for a liberty-based podcast, huh?
Well, you know. It's just, it's levels of just things not being right with the world. And it feels very much, and I've talked with other people not in the whole liberty movement, you know, people who are just people
mm-hmm.
and who don't watch the news and don't think about it. And even people, just regular people.
Normal people.
Are talking about how there's something not right with the world.
Yeah.
You know, you can't escape that fact. There's a sickness that is going through the world right now. And you know, you can debate what the causes are, but I really believe that the cause is an evil worship of what amounts to a really terrible religion.
Which is statism. Yeah, this goofy idea that a small group of people can dictate to the rest of humanity how to live, and that small group of people lives off the back of everyone else's labor. And we are supposed to believe that's good.
Yeah.
There's, you know, without getting into a big biblical thing, there's a biblical passage that says something like, you know, woe unto those who call evil good and good evil. And when you accept the idea of a state, when you say that there's one small group of people who should decide what the law is, who should inflict law upon everybody else, and who are exempt, to a large extent, exempt from that law, and who live on the labor of everybody else. And when you take that idea and you say, this is good, it's good for this small group of people to use violence and aggression to enforce their will on everybody else, but it's not good for us to own our own property, stand up for ourselves, defend ourselves. You are doing exactly what that scripture says. You are taking something that is blatantly evil and demanding that it be recognized as good. And you're taking good, things like self-defense, property ownership, things like that, self-determination, and you're calling those things evil. So when a person is sitting in their home, minding their own business, not harming anyone, and because of a confusion on an address, a SWAT team comes busting into your house without knocking, without any kind of identification. They just come busting into your house.
Dressed all in black.
Yeah, with their faces covered, which is how they do. And your first response is to stand up and defend your home, your property, and your family. And they shoot you down like a dog. You're the bad guy.
Yep.
You've done wrong
yep.
for defending yourself and defending your family. And all of society will look at you and say, well, you shouldn't have been shooting at a cop. Well, like Larkin Rose asked the question, when should you shoot at a cop? Well, if we're going to say never, then how are we any different
mm-hmm.
than other people throughout history that have been complete slaves to their masters? How are we
especially
different?
Especially since you are more likely to be murdered by a cop than you are anyone else in society. And I'm not talking about, you know, accidentally shot in the line of, no, nothing. Murdered. Absolute murder.
Yeah, FBI statistics show that of all the people in society that are most likely to murder someone, a cop is number one on the list.
Yeah.
And you can make reasons. You can say, well, the pressures that they're under, the psychological stress that they're under. I mean, you know, there's a lot of reasons behind something like this, but it's still a fact.
Yeah.
That's just the fact.
Yeah.
Actual murder, cops murder at a higher rate than the rest of society.
Yep.
Well, we got a break for commercial. We'll be right back in 60 seconds.
Admit it. You hate shopping for Christmas. You do. It's a hassle coupled with a burden, mechanically checking off friends, relatives, and coworkers from your list. You're probably not even religious, but if you are, is buying your cousin some little made-in-China piece of plastic really celebrating the birth of your savior? This holiday season, why buy gifts for friends and relatives? Most of them are statists anyway. You should send that money to the Freedom Fiends instead. The Freedom Fiends will use your money to help spread education of horizontal liberation throughout the world. If you want to help provide inoculation from indoctrination, go to freedomfiends.com and click on the spinning coin on any post to send your money to the Fiends instead. Because buying crap for unappreciative statist relatives won't get your name on the golden floppy disk of redemption. And if you must shop for Christmas, please do it through the Freedom Fiends Amazon link over on the right side of freedomfiends.com. It won't cost you anything extra, and Amazon will save you the danger of holiday drive-by stabbings at your local mall. Amazon pretty much sells everything you can buy on this earth, except for guns and weed. But they do sell the DVD Guns and Weed: The Road to Freedom, so get that for your gun-hating stoner brother or neocon gun nut dad. They'll thank you for it. That's freedomfiends.com.
And thanks for sticking with us through the break. And you probably just heard the lovely voice of Michael Dean doing a Christmas commercial for the Freedom Fiends. How about that? Okay, so now we took off and I ranted and raved about stuff that was not, we weren't even going to talk about any of that stuff. But going back to the property rights thing, do we need to clarify that really a lot of the inheritance and those things are cultural norms. They're not necessarily based on rights.
Right.
You could say that there's preferential behavior, but that's different from the rights.
Right. Well, I think, you know, when you have the instance of like a will, what you have there is somebody who owns property and has given it to somebody with the idea that you will receive it once you're dead.
Mm-hmm.
Once that person is dead, you know.
Yeah, so you have a contractual agreement.
Right, you have a contractual agreement, which, again, is not a right. You don't have a right to make a contractual agreement, but it is sort of, you have given that person property, you know, and now it is their property.
Well, since contracts don't exist in nature, a contract, again, is a cultural norm, so we make contracts and we obey contracts based on honor.
Mm-hmm.
And honor is something that can be a societal norm. We can say, okay, so there are some people who will break contracts and there are some people who will honor contracts.
Mm-hmm.
And we learn among us who will break contracts and who will honor contracts. So, you know, it's like any other thing involving the truth. If you have two people who are selling boats, and you go to one of them, and he tells you this is a good boat, you know, and he promises you that this is a good boat, and you buy the boat from him, and it sinks because it's full of holes, well, then you understand that this is not a truthful person, so you don't make contracts with him, and you spread the word. You say, well, that guy, don't buy a boat from that guy. He sells boats with holes in them. And then you find another guy who is honest and tells the truth and will sell you a boat. He says, hey, I think this might have a crack in the hull. You might want to check it out. At least you know ahead of time, and he's honest with you. Okay, so now you can have it fixed before you take it out on a lake. So then you can tell people, well, that guy's an honest boat salesman. So society has ways of normalizing these things, but none of that has anything to do with rights.
Right.
Because none of that is inherent by nature. But something like owning property is inherent by nature. And we can see this because if you take a little baby, and one of the early things a baby understands to do is to latch onto things, grab things, mm-hmm. whether that be in nursing or whether that be in trying to understand what things are with his hands. But right off the bat, he will start learning how to grasp things. And if you try to take something away from that baby, now this is a baby that has never had any trainings, so to speak, of any kind. He's not polluted by society. But if you try to take away from something that that baby has clutched onto, then you see right immediately mm-hmm. that property rights are inherent. Property rights are natural and are built hardwired into our brains.
Mm-hmm. Hey, baby, stop homesteading my finger.
Well, you know, the homesteader is not always correct in their assumptions, but the desire is there. The natural tendency is there. So we have this difference between what an actual right is, what we're born with, a birthright, a thing that's natural to human beings, and we have those things which are convenient to human beings, which right. are important for life.
And there are a lot of things that are terribly important for a happy, healthy, successful life and a happy, healthy, successful society that are not rights.
Yeah, exactly. We were talking about that. There was an article on Lou Rockwell. No, there wasn't. I'm sorry. On the Lou Rockwell blog, in the the back pages of Lou Rockwell, there's been an ongoing discussion of several of the prominent Lou Rockwell posters as to whether there is a right to privacy. And the point of contention being Murray Rothbard said, you have no right to privacy. You have right to property.
Right.
And then if you want that property to be private, you have to put effort to make it private and keep it private. And so somebody, of course, Murray is dead for many years and can't defend himself on this, but somebody else, one of the other writers there that I can't remember his name, wrote up a thing in the blog that said Murray's wrong. And he gave his argument, and then Walter Block rang in and said, no, Murray is right. And he made his argument, and then a couple other people rang in as well. What's your take on that whole situation?
Well, my take is you can only have rights. There's a terminology for it, and I don't remember, but it's like positive and negative rights or something like that. But you can only have rights basically that...
Don't take from
other people.
Right.
Like, I have the right to food. Mm-hmm. Okay? Well, if I have the right to food, that means that no matter what I do, I have to have food. So that means other people have to give it to me, which violates their rights.
Right.
So I don't have the right to food.
Right.
I have a need for food. Mm-hmm. I personally am not going to live a long and successful and healthy life without food. But I have no right to food. Now, I have the right to attempt to get nourishment and food and things without harming other people.
Right.
Nobody can take that right away from me. But I don't have the right to have food. So it's the same thing with privacy. I have a need for privacy. Psychologically, socially, all of this, there's a need for privacy, but it's not a right, because a right says I have this special magic, you have to give me privacy, but it's you have to give me privacy, and that's infringing upon somebody else.
Yeah, exactly. So for instance, let's take it in the direction of copyright protection, or not copyright, intellectual property, because oftentimes libertarians will make the argument that, well, we have to have some kind of, even if we don't have government-enforced intellectual property, there is right to intellectual property. But the problem there comes into exactly what we're talking about here. You have, let's say you have an idea, okay? I have an idea of if I had a rock that was rounded on the edges, you know, smooth all the way around its border, and then turned on one side, it would roll better. And I could, you know, poke a hole through the middle and put a stick through there. And it would be easier to, you know, put a burden on that and pull it than for me to carry the same burden. So I have this idea, right? Now, I can have that idea, and it's mine. It's in my head, and I own it. It's my idea. It's my property. But when I make that object, when I express that idea out in the open, and someone else sees it, I don't have a right to what their eyes see. I don't have a right to light bouncing off of an object. You see, so if I want to keep my right to my intellectual property, I have to keep it a secret. It's up to me to keep it a secret. Get it out of my brain, then they're violating my property rights.
Right. Or if they want to come onto your property and rifle through your stuff and find it, that's a violation of my property rights.
Exactly. Because it all boils down to property. Okay, so what if they're on the far edge of my property looking really hard and they see it? Well, again, I don't have a right to what light bounces off of.
Exactly. And I think that's, you know, you do have to take it to that, because what is happening there? Well, what is happening is, you know, light is
reflecting
off of that and coming into their eyeballs. Mm. Well, I can't say to somebody, hey, that's my light that's going into your eyes. You can't use that light.
Right.
You can't do that. That's not legitimate, you know. If I want to have that and have nobody else see that, it's up to me to find a way to devise how to do that, whether that's building a wall around it or keeping it underground or in a locked closet or however I want to avoid other people seeing it. That's up to me.
Right.
You know, and if I'm just walking down the street with it, it's not up to other people to look away.
Yeah. Or it's not up to a cop to force other people to look away.
Yeah.
And so how do I protect my invention of this wheel? How do I protect it? Well, there's a couple of ways I can protect it. I can hide it on my own property. I can disguise it so that I can use it without it being obvious what it is. I can do any of those things with it and still remain within my property rights. What I can't do is give it to somebody else or exchange it with somebody else and then have some kind of ownership over it after I've already exchanged it and no longer own it.
Right.
You know, if we were doing anything like, okay, tacos and apples. You've got apples, I've got tacos. I'm like, hey, I really would like an apple. And you're like, okay, for two tacos, you can have an apple. So we exchange. And then you start munching down. Did I get that right? Yeah. You start munching down one of the tacos. And I'm like, hey, what are you doing? That's my taco. You can't eat that. Well, yeah, you traded an apple for it. It's yours now. You know, I don't have ownership over something after I traded.
Right.
Well, then how can Microsoft tell me that once I pay them $200 or $300 for a series of ones and O's on a disc, how is it after I pay them a crazy amount of money for it that they're going to tell me what I can and can't do with it?
Yep.
I can only use it this way. I can't use it that way. I can load it on this computer, but I can't load it on that computer. How do they have that right? How is that? See, that's not a natural thing. Now, secrets. Okay, so Microsoft can write it in such a secret way that only they can unlock its secrets. That's how, if you want to call it intellectual property, that's how that intellectual property can be protected, through secrecy. And that's how guilds used to, before guilds were an aspect of the government.
Right.
That's how guilds used to protect ideas. So the only people who knew how to build a building out of stone that wouldn't fall on your heads were the masons who had been trained and who knew the techniques. And they keep them all secret among their own guild. And that's perfectly legitimate within property rights. I mean, within property rights and within a libertarian framework. But once the government comes in and uses aggression, rather than the guild maintaining a secrecy based on honor, once the secrecy based on honor goes out the window, and government thugs come in and use aggression to enforce it, then it's no longer a proper libertarian. It's not based on rights anymore. It's based on aggression.
So, yeah, I think part of what the article was really saying, because I think he had two different, problems. I think firstly, he wanted to figure out how he could make privacy be a right, which you can't. But then I think also that he had this idea that, you know, there's such a lack of privacy in our society today that it's really intolerable, and there needs to be a way to gain back some of that privacy. And I do agree with that.
Sure, yeah.
You know, but again, that's, you know, he uses the example of if a cop comes in and puts wiretapping in your house, well, that's a violation of property rights.
Right.
That's not a violation of privacy rights. It's a violation of property rights.
Yeah.
And if you're walking down the street and you're being videotaped against your will, again, that's not an issue of privacy rights. That's an issue of property rights. And the reason it's an issue of property rights is because I don't have a choice in whose street I can walk down.
Yeah.
I don't have a choice of whose intersection I can drive through. I have to drive through the state's intersection. And so the state holds a monopoly on that. And so that, you know, then they can go and videotape me. Well, if there were an open market, if there were proper property rights, that wouldn't be an issue.
Yeah, because somebody would offer private streets where they would guarantee that you would have privacy on those streets. They would guarantee that you wouldn't be videotaped, or you would, you know, they would have videotape-free zones, perhaps. And maybe you pay a little extra for that or whatever.
Or maybe not. Maybe without the influence of the state, there wouldn't be anybody who would need to videotape people 24/7.
Yeah, exactly. Because really, all the problems, privacy is no different than any other problem that you might present that boils back to the problem that the state is here aggressing on everyone, stealing their property, living off of the labor of other people, enforcing laws upon us that are not real laws, that are just the whims of politicians. So if you take away all those things, privacy wouldn't be a problem. You know, because, but now they have machines. They have a van that they can drive down the street and search cars and search pedestrians just by driving past them. And they use this backscatter technology, whatever that means. And they can see if they're carrying a gun. They can see if they're carrying, you know, a package of some forbidden plant. Or they can see whatever that they need to see. They can do that just driving past you. So we need to have privacy because of all the... Or you go to the airport and they pat you down and they feel where they shouldn't be feeling and they send you through a machine that they should. So we have to have privacy. But the problem is not the privacy.
Right.
The problem in all of this is the aggression of the government, of the state, the concept that the government can do these things. That corporations, in conjunction with the government, can inflict themselves upon us, violating our property rights. It's not privacy; it's property.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I have a right to be secure in myself, in the things that I own and possess. But I have a certain responsibility to keep that stuff private. So, if I'm walking down the street naked, I shouldn't be upset because someone sees me.
Right.
But if I put on clothing that's almost see-through and walk down the street, same thing.
Right.
It's not the fault of the observer. It's the fault of the person walking down the street. And if I put on clothing that's a little heavier, but there are people in the street with machines that can see through that, and I know that, then you get into this loop of where the responsibility is just, eventually you're wearing foil clothing.
Right.
You know, well, okay, then wear foil clothing. But the issue is not... what the technology is doing or who's viewing what. It's the fact that we're being robbed from to pay for these people to aggress upon us, and then we want to complain about the way they're aggressing, not the fact that they exist at all.
Right. Because at the end of the day, without the state being there, there would be no reason for anyone to do those things.
Right. There would be no funding for the police to do all this nonsense. We have to do something about the gang problem in the cities. No, you don't. Oh, we have to stop the immigration. All these illegal people coming up here from Mexico, and there's violent people among them, and they're stealing jobs, and they're coming up here, and they're getting on welfare, and they're doing all these horrible things, and there's criminals among them, and they're doing these horrible things. We have to crack down on the border. No, you don't.
Yeah.
No, you're completely wrong on everything you just said.
Well, I think...
Well, hold on, because people are going to freak out and email me. Because the drug war fuels all those things. The drug war fuels the gangs in the cities. The drug war fuels what's going on the borders.
Not just the drug war. Farm subsidies. And it is such a complex issue. I made this argument about the shoeless homeless dude.
Right.
You know, and the cop who's just trying to be a nice guy. And I truly believe that he honestly was trying to be a nice guy. And he sees, here's this homeless guy. He has no shoes. It's New York City. It's middle of winter. It's cold. I'm going to go buy him some shoes because I'm a nice guy. There are so many layers of problems that have created this homeless person sitting here on the sidewalk with no shoes that just handing him shoes doesn't solve the issue.
It actually makes the issue worse.
It does. You know, and the media goes and finds this dude and, you know, 2 weeks later or whatever, and they're like, "Oh, you're still shoeless." And he's like, "Well, yeah, I'm not going to wear those
$100 shoes.
That'll get me killed."
Yeah.
And it will. You know, and so I appreciate that the cop was trying to be a nice guy, but at the end of the day, it's such a complex issue that you can't just put a Band-Aid on it. You can't say, you can't look all the way down at the result of it and say, "Oh, well, you know, I'll fix this." You have to say, what is the cause of this?
And ultimately, if the cop understood all the levels of everything that's wrong, the first thing he should do is rip off his uniform and throw it on the desk of his boss and quit.
Yeah.
Because he's the problem. The state is the problem. That's the root, literally the root of the evil, is the concept that some humans can dominate other humans. And that's where it's at. That's the problem with immigration. That's the problem with the drug war. That's the problem with gangs. That's the problem with airport security. That's the problem with terrorism. That's what creates terrorism around the world, is governments aggressing upon innocent people, creates innocent people who are now angry that a government aggressed upon them, and they want to do something about it.
Yep.
Well, we better break again because we're overrunning each one of our breaks.
And now a word from our sponsors. Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby.
Did you know author Taryn P. Lupo has a new novel out called One Nation Under Blood? When a rejuvenative blood technology is developed that pits the young against the old, the government must take firm steps to address the war of supply and demand brewing across generational lines. Blood is not the only thing bought and sold in this dystopian tale of technology, economics, and independence. Vampires are now very real, but we never expected them to wear our grandmother's best Sunday dress. The Bad Quaker staff has discovered how easy it is to get everything you need for the holidays at Amazon. Everything from the coolest decorations to hangover remedies, and everything from the latest movies and music to poop stain remover. If you follow the Amazon link at badquaker.com, Amazon will give badquaker.com a tiny portion of the purchase. It won't cost you any... And we're back.
Yay!
So, back onto the property issue, let's shift gears a little bit. How much property in, using the Freedom Fiends terminology in LibPair, in Libertarian Paradise, mm-hmm. How much property would be, in giant air quotes here, allowed? How much property could a person rightfully own in LibPair? Could a person like Ted Turner owns... over 2 million acres, and he's the second largest individual landowner in the U.S. The largest landowner in the U.S. is a guy named John Malone. I don't even know who that is.
I have no idea.
But he owns 2.2 million acres in the U.S. And, of course, neither of them even comes close to the supposed property rights of the U.S. government that owns almost the entirety of the West, of the, you know, of the American Southwest, the U.S. government, you know, I'm again in air quotes, owns almost the entirety of the Southwest. Well, how much in a libpair, how much property could a person own?
I think, you know, as much as you're able to homestead, as much as you are physically capable of protecting and maintaining and keeping and improving.
So then do we get together and steal, do we take away some of Ted Turner's 2 million acres? Well, again, the answer is there would be no Ted Turner with 2 million acres in a libertarian paradise, because the aggression of the government would have never given him the kind of monopoly advantages in the marketplace that allowed him to gain the kind of ridiculous levels of wealth that he obtained.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And if he had actually, through a free open market, attained that level, and he wants to spend his money hiring private security to guard his 2 million or whatever it is.
Yeah, 2 million.
Good for him.
Yeah, then he can own 2 million or 10 million or whatever. But still, that's a drop in the bucket compared to the amount of vacant land that's available in the southwestern United States that nobody is allowed to touch because of the aggression of the government.
Yeah.
The problem is not...
It is just continuing to turn into desert.
Yeah.
I mean, desert is literally the only biosphere that is increasing in size in the world.
That's because you drive an SUV.
I don't drive an SUV. I drive a Jeep.
That's an SUV.
It's not an SUV. It's a Jeep. It's a Jeep. Jeeps are their own special designation. It's a Jeep.
According to many politicians, you're driving an SUV and you're making the world a desert.
Politicians are wrong. My river wouldn't do any such thing.
Politicians work for the devil.
For the devil! But yeah, you know, if it is not impossible to grow food in the desert.
Right.
It just requires that you have a market that needs you to.
Yeah, and also, you know, the water management in the western United States is so, boy, I could do a whole podcast just on how messed up water management is in the western United States. And it is literally all because of the aggression of government. Some states, you're not even allowed to catch the rainwater that falls on the roof of your house that you own. You're not allowed to catch the rainwater and then do what you want with it.
But the United States government is allowed to divert massive rivers and completely shut down all farming in Mexico.
Yeah, and they do that. The United States government has consistently cut back the amount of water that they're allowing to go into Mexico in the Colorado River. And its whole communities have had to relocate because farming communities that were literally centuries old had to...
Totally self-sufficient.
Yeah. Had to basically pack up and move because they could no longer farm where they have traditionally farmed in their own lands. And also at the mouth of the Colorado River, there used to be abundant fishing, and there were fishing villages all over that area. And because the U.S. government has cut off the water, not completely, but they may as well have, they've cut off so much of the water going into Mexico and the Colorado River that the Colorado River no longer reaches the sea. So all these fishing communities, they, you know, unemployment, they ended up depending on the government. They were Indian, Native American Indians, so they ended up having to go on reservations just for food.
Yep.
So that made them dependent upon the Mexican government.
They didn't have to. Their other option is to, you know, be part of the drug war.
Yeah, yeah, or they could smuggle, yeah, exactly. Which, oddly enough, it's better to take the risk of getting killed trying to smuggle drugs across the border for someone else than to go into a government-sanctioned, basically a compound, basically a concentration camp, which is that's what the reservations are. They're concentration camps.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a preferable situation for a poor farmer that can no longer farm for him to carry somebody else's drugs across the desert, risking getting killed by the American government that's a better option than going into one of the government concentration camps that they call reservations.
Yep.
That's pretty much. And so what do we do? What's the solution? We have to figure out a way to help the American Indian. No, kill the government.
Yeah.
The government's the source of the problem.
Stop making things worse.
Yeah. It's this belief in the state that makes us completely forget that the government is the source of the problem.
Yep.
The problem is not how much water runs down the Colorado River. Oh, and I should say, why would the U.S. government divert all that water from the Colorado River? Well, what do they do with it? Well, a good portion of it goes into the Imperial Valley in California, into really leaky reservoirs and really leaky canals that lose, some of those canals lose 60, 70% of the water that goes into them. But they don't care because it doesn't cost the government anything.
Right.
You know? So they divert that water into the Imperial Valley in California to monocrop alfalfa, which is also subsidized through farm subsidies, and then they harvest that alfalfa for what? For the dairy production, which is also totally controlled by the government. And so alfalfa farming is subsidized through the water that they stole from Mexico. And then it's taken, that subsidized alfalfa is taken to dairy farms, which are controlled by the government. And then milk production is done, and then the price of the milk is fixed, and the quantities and the type of the milk is all fixed by the government, and so it's the fault of the evil Mexicans, right? It's the evil Mexican drug lord's fault, right?
Well, yeah, absolutely. And you know, it's those evil Mexicans that are coming up here and stealing our jobs.
And that's what we're told to believe.
Yeah.
We're not told that they wouldn't be coming up here if we didn't cut off their water and starve out their farming. Well, I didn't do it.
Did you do it?
Did you do that?
Yes, it was me. I admit it. Oh, you got me.
You went down there and dammed up the Colorado River again.
I get so bored. You know, you're there. There's the Colorado River. What are you supposed to do? It's a fun afternoon.
Okay, now, on a totally unrelated note, we're actually recording this Sunday morning for Monday morning's podcast, so we're trying to get one step ahead of the game.
Look
here.
Look at us, all ahead of time.
Yeah, because normally we're doing everything in our lives at the last moment. So this is an attempt to get one step ahead by recording a day early. But this evening, Sunday evening, I'm going to be on the Freedom Fiends with Michael W. Dean. Nima is taking the night off. And so I'm going to be Michael's co-host, and it's the plan for Michael to introduce me as Nima. And then I'm going to just go on and talk like I'm Nima, except, you know, it's me. And Michael's going to pretend like he's like, Nima, what's wrong with your voice? And so that's our little game we're going to play on the podcast. I don't know how it'll go. By the time that this podcast actually reaches, you know, the air of the internet, the Freedom Fiends Sunday night podcast will already be done. So it may be a total failure, or it may be funny, or it may not be funny, or who knows.
Who knows? But that is that going to be a live podcast?
It will be live.
But they'll have the recording of it available.
Yeah, by the time this podcast is out, probably that podcast will be available for download, because Michael's really good about that. He just grabs them, edits them right away, and puts them back up again. Matter of fact, I don't think he really even edits that much. He just, you know, trims up the worst of it and puts it out there. He doesn't go through, you know, minute by minute and editing it like I do. I take out every weird noise and dog barking and everything that I can.
For you, listeners. For you.
Yeah, we do that for you. Actually, that's part of the reason that that this podcast sounds a little bit better than some others, because I do take, if you hear a 1 hour podcast recording, what you don't realize maybe is that it took like an hour and a half to record that. And it took, if it's just me by myself, I probably have anywhere from 4 to 8, maybe 12 or 15 hours of note, you know, production before that, before I even record it. And then in addition to that, after it's all recorded, there's another hour and a half to 2 hours, sometimes 3 hours of editing to take out the interruptions, sneezes, dog barks, you know, mailman, all those kind of things that take place. So in one-hour podcast of Bad Quaker podcast, it can take, you know, what, 12 hours or so at times?
Yeah.
Probably an average is more like 6 hours. Now, it's a lot faster when it's you and I doing it.
Right.
Because we just mostly go off the cuff.
Right.
We might, like this time we had one topic we were going to touch, which was that article, that blog post at Lou Rockwell.
Right.
That I can't even remember the guy's name.
David Resniff?
Is that it? How about Rozif?
Rozif. David Rozif.
No, Michael.
David.
Michael.
David.
Michael.
David.
Michael.
David.
Michael.
David.
Michael.
David.
I think it's Michael Rozif.
Rozniff. Sure, David. $5 says it.
Ben is right. Ben is right. As always, Ben is right. Who is it, Kai?
Like I said all along, it was Michael. Michael.
Rozif.
Rozif.
Anyway, so that was our start. We started with that one kind of one notation that we were going to talk about that. And then the whole rest of the podcast was just mostly ranting about things and Kai clarifying.
If you couldn't tell.
Yeah.
I know it sounds like we have this all planned out and that it's scripted and everything, but as a matter of fact, we just kind of ramble a bit.
But that's our best, you know, sometimes we'll get together, you just be sitting at the kitchen table at, you know, 9:30 at night or something, and take off for 3 hours, and it'll be a great podcast, except we didn't record it.
Yeah, we do that a lot. We need to stop doing that.
We need to have a microphone on the kitchen table and just flip it on as soon as we start to talk. And then, because that is, you know, doing that saves me, by us podcasting, just our own random thoughts like this, that saves me anywhere from 4 to 6 or 8 hours of research and, you know, note writing. And I started doing some notes for, well, okay, let me back up a little bit. And I put this on the forum in the members section that I'm starting to do research on a CIA project. Not working for the CIA, of course. But what happened was I was messing around on CIA.gov, which is the CIA's, you know.
Well, that was your first mistake.
Yeah. And I found this article that was written by one of the directors of the CIA that was in defense of the CIA, because when the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan in 1979, then President Carter, when he came out in his public address referring to this, he acted like he had no clue this was going to happen. It's like, this is a shock. This is like, you know, it's like December 7th, 1941, all over again. Who would have suspected that the Russians were getting ready to invade Afghanistan? I can't believe they would have done this. It was kind of like that, right? Kind of a dramatic moment.
Right.
And so there was actually, in the 80s then, there was a congressional investigation as to why the CIA didn't know that Russia was about to invade. And so this guy, this CIA director, much later then, wrote up this whole letter. Well, it was a, what would you call it? An essay. It's like an essay explaining what the CIA knew, when they knew it, and when they told the different levels of government. And so I found this thing on the CIA.gov, and I started, I'm looking at it, and I go, this is interesting, but it's written in such a way that you can't tell, it's not in a, you can't tell what the sequence of thing of order is, because it's not written like a timeline. The guy skips around and goes back and forth. This happened in 74, this happened in 79, this happened in 76, this happened in 81, this happened in 54, you know.
Right.
And it's really, you, and this is the problem with all everything CIA related that I've ever read. They write things in such a way, and I think they do this intentionally. They write things in such a way where they leave themselves levels of plausible deniability.
Right.
So they can always say, no, 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 you didn't understand what I meant. I meant it the innocent way. So when I said that we executed this guy who was a totally innocent person, but he knew too much, what I meant was we didn't execute this guy who was a totally innocent person. Who, you know, I mean, they write stuff like that. So I'm reading this guy's stuff, and it's like, this makes no sense. I need to make a timeline. So I started making a timeline, and then as I read his things, I would bounce back and forth in the timeline and put it all in the right order. And I probably had about, I'm going to say, right now I've probably got 8 hours of research into this guy's one letter. Because then he refers to other things, like he'll refer to the New York Times or he'll refer to some other document or some other thing. And then I'll have to go out and find out what they were actually talking about, whether or not he's even telling the truth, and then bring that back in and put it in the timeline. So I've probably got 8 hours or so into it, and I'm probably a good, I'll bet I'm a good 6 or 8 hours away from finishing. Just finishing the timeline, then I've got to put it in a usable order of notes for a podcast. And this is all in building up to find out why is the U.S. in Afghanistan today? Well, you can't answer why is the U.S. in Afghanistan today unless you answer why was the CIA in Afghanistan for 2 decades before the U.S. invaded.
Right.
And so I'm putting together all these notes for one podcast, maybe two, as to, you know, in Afghanistan, basically, is what I'm talking about. So for some upcoming podcast that I do someday for the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan, I've already got maybe 16, maybe 20 hours of research, and it may be a month before I even do that podcast.
Right.
So I took some of my raw notes and stuck them in the members area of the forum, just as kind of a teaser. This is how I do my notes, just as sort of a behind-the-scenes glimpse. So I guess that's another commercial for the forum then, isn't it?
That's right. Of course, it doesn't help if you're putting that out for the members and then you tell everybody on the podcast that those are all your notes.
Well, then maybe they'll want to go and be a member and go in and read them.
That's true. Sneaky, hidden surprises, things you'll never guess.
Anyway, we should probably wrap this up.
Probably.
Thanks for coming on the podcast today, Kai.
No problem.
And remember, get over to badquaker.com. where liberty is our mission. Thanks a lot, folks.